Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're going to let President Obama kick off our next conversation. Here he is last week at the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner.
Speaking of Rand Paul, Colorado legalized marijuana this year. An interesting social experiment. I do hope it doesn't lead to a whole lot of paranoid people who think that the federal government's out to get them and listening to their phone calls. That would be a problem.
Talk about truth in jest for a lot of people, from former NSA employees to whistleblowers like Edward Snowden and New York Times reporter James Risen, who was with us a couple of months ago. The NSA is hardly a laughing matter. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about how extensive and expansive the NSA surveillance program has become since 9/11 is Michael Kirk. Michael's the director, writer, and producer of the new Frontline documentary, which is both thrilling and frightening. The United States of Secrets, Part 1, airs tonight. Michael, good to see you again.
Thanks, Jim. Nice to be here.
Michael, thank you so much for coming in. Excuse me. As I said before, by the time I finished your spectacular documentary, I was enraged at everybody, George Bush, Barack Obama, the FBI, the overweening, scary, frightening power of the federal government. You start and end with Edward Snowden, but a lot of your documentary is about the lives of very good public servants basically being devastated. So tell people what the thesis is. What's this documentary about?
Once upon a time, there was an agency in the United States of America that had spied on Americans and got its fingers slapped for doing it in the 1970s. The rule of thumb, the great bright white line at the agency, which was unbelievably powerful in its ability to surveil, eavesdrop, and wiretap, was never turn those eyes and ears towards Americans. And the people who worked there, patriotic, hardworking, good American sort of pocket protector kind of scientists, believed that line, believed it. And then this thing called 9/11 happened. And almost as fast as, faster than you can imagine, the rules were changed, the lines were blurred, and the government, the National Security Agency, turned all of that power on the American people. And the people who did the turning, the scientists, those pocket protector people, witnessed it, and many, many of them worried a lot about it and talked to us.
Yeah, speaking of the pocket protector people, and that's so perfect. Here is former NSA employee Wiebe and journalist James Bamford on how the NSA actually learned about 9/11. Listen to this.
Oh, my goodness. There is smoke pouring out of the Pentagon.
Everybody had the TV on because the TV is where the news was. It wasn't coming out of NSA's computers. It was on the TV because we had missed the entire event.
Quickly coming down.
This is a live picture. We are seeing.
Oh, my God. It was an enormous shock that you have this huge agency set up to prevent a surprise attack, and they learn about it on a $300 television set tuned to CNN in the director's office.
It's almost perfect because we've seen the NSA building. We've been introduced by you and your colleagues, Michael, to the massive amounts of data that's being collected, and it's on CNN that they learn about this thing.
They missed it entirely, you guys. And when they went back 3 days later and started to look, they discovered that some of the hijackers who took the planes were staying in a motel right in the shadow of the NSA out in Fort Meade in Maryland, that they went to an ATM, not a 10-minute drive from the NSA, that they had actual intercepts, the NSA, on its vast data reservoirs that said the game's on, tonight's the night. All of that, and they had missed it all because, of course, they had all the data. They weren't supposed to have some of it. They didn't know that part of those conversations were happening in San Diego and Washington. And I think the regret and guilt inside the NSA on those first couple of days was palpable and really phenomenal and contributed to what happened over the next day.
And by the way, it was Keystone Cops-like, and the natural inclination, which I'm glad to hear, is we have to figure out how to do this better. But the problem, as you lay out in a couple of hours, is better wasn't just the rule. Broader and, in many cases, unconstitutional was the rule.
Well, when you talk, Michael, about the terrible guilt and regret some of these NSA people felt, we have an NSA engineer here, Edward Loomis, who's describing that had the NSA operated differently, 9/11 could have been prevented. Let's hear from Ed Loomis.
I do believe it could have been prevented with revisions to the way we were permitted to operate before 9/11. Revisions that I tried to get the general counsel to embrace and couldn't. I tried to get them to make adjustments to how we were operating, how we were permitted to operate, and they wouldn't do it. I felt this ever since it occurred, that over 3,000 people's lives were lost, and it's just a weight that I have been having trouble bearing.
Michael, before we get to the NSA spying on everybody, which is what they eventually ended up doing, he seemed to be talking about a middle ground where there might have been something between having no idea, his learning about this on television, and where we eventually went. Was he correct about that? Was there a middle ground?
Yes, of course. Many people at the NSA, the scientists working there, knew in the 90s, as the agency itself was becoming moribund, the Cold War was over, we weren't interested in spending lots of money on spy things around the world. We didn't yet know that there was a threat coming from a group called Al-Qaeda. At least we didn't recognize how big the threat was. But the guys working there, watching Silicon Valley grow, said, hey, wait a minute, we're behind the curve here. And they went to work on a program called Thin Thread, which was very straightforward, kind of an elegant solution. Essentially what it would do was grab people in this big kind of dragnet network setup, kind of like Facebook, find them, encrypt the ones that were in America, because they knew that because many of the internet hubs are running through the United States, they might as well, this is the place to go to get it. But the law seemed to preclude them from knowing about Americans. So they encrypted the data, anonymizing the American portions of it. Unless they heard something, a safe house in Yemen calling a house in San Diego, then they could go to the FISA court, a special secret court inside the Justice Department, and say to them, we need a warrant so we can listen to and explore how many phone calls were from Yemen to this number and who from this number in San Diego. Where did they call else in the United States? And we can find people. We can create, in three hops, they can create several million people who are connected to a phone call in Yemen. But, and they knew that they could do that, but they had to create a thing that was a system that was relatively inexpensive, very elegant in its ability to capture lots of people, and anonymizing Americans so that they could do it in the United States. They thought they had it, but the NSA, nervous at the time about crossing that line into American spying, wouldn't let them go.
I have to say, I've never heard the verb anonymizing before, but I love it. It says it all.
It's a term of art.
A sudden, there were a bunch of people in powerful positions, Mike Kirk, who decided that anonymizing, encrypting the names of Americans, unless essentially there's probable cause, which is what the Constitution says.
Right.
If you get some information, you have probable cause, you go get a warrant. They decided that wasn't enough. And what then happened?
What happens is that Thin Thread becomes a piece of a much larger, quicker idea. The vice president calls George Tenet at the CIA. Tenet calls Mike Hayden, who runs the NSA. And Tenet says to Hayden, hey, the vice president and David Addington, his top lawyer and aide, want to do something, realize we have to do something we have never done before, which is we've really got to stretch this out. We've got to turn it aggressively on the bad guys around the world and in the United States, because they were worried about sleeper cells. Remember, we all thought, oh, my God, they're everywhere. So Tenet says to Hayden, what can you do? Be thinking big stuff. And Hayden, the head of the NSA, says, no, I can't do it, not within my existing authorities. And Tenet says to him, that's not the question I ask. He said, what could you do? So Hayden comes to his staff at the NSA and he says, take the gloves off, the familiar phrase that was also used at the CIA, and said, bring me an aggressive plan. They did. And the aggressive plan turned out to be Thin Thread without the anonymizing. And in other words, without the encryption of all the American stuff and a lot more. So in order to go find the bad guys, the few bad guys that were out there, what they decided to do was capture information on everybody all over the world.
You know, a lot of people were criticized during the Bush presidency for belittling him by saying, oh, he wasn't the president. The president was Dick Cheney. When you watch the United States of Secrets, you realize for these purposes, it was President Cheney. Memos, critical memos, were not drafted as they ordinarily would be by the White House counsel, the Department of Justice, but by this David Addington for the vice president. And finally, when the president of the United States is told about some of these things by concerned great public servants, it's pretty clear to me, and I assume that this is the impression we were to get, Michael, he had no idea what was going on about a lot of the stuff that Cheney and Addington were running through the government. That's a fair description, yes?
Yeah, I think this film is the first time, you know, I've been doing a version of this story for 10 years, and lots of films about Iraq and the Iraq War and the webs of mass destruction and all of that spying and torture. And this is the first time we managed to get Alberto Gonzalez, who was his chief lawyer, the president's chief lawyer, eventually becomes attorney general, and Andy Card, who was the chief of staff. So we can triangulate what was going on.
And a Massachusetts guy, by the way, a former state rep. We've spoken to him a number of times.
Exactly, yeah. and an otherwise fine citizen, except for the work that he did and didn't do on behalf of bringing the president the information that he might have needed about the existence of this program, the thing we call the program, which is the massive spying, metadata capturing, everything about telephones and internet. So the president didn't know. We're certain of that from both what Gonzalez told us and what Andy Card told us, until the very, very end, when about a half a dozen people at the Justice Department and the head of the FBI, Bob Mueller, are threatening to resign if the program isn't, or a portion of the program isn't, turned off. And the president looks at Jim Comey and Mueller in a secret meeting, two secret meetings inside the White House, and says, "Why didn't you bring this information to me earlier?" And Comey says to him, this is the acting attorney general, says to him, if you didn't know about this for the last 3 months, you're being poorly served by the people close to you," which would also be Card and whatever. What it really means is that the vice president and David Addington were running the show.
We're talking to Michael Kirk, who's the man behind United States of Secrets. You can see it tonight. It's a Frontline production. You can see it tonight on PBS.
Well, one of the few encouraging things as an American, I mean, you did a great job, but it was very depressing watching this. But one of the encouraging things was the bravery of a lot of these bureaucrats and people within the NSA who knew that it was wrong to be doing this level of surveillance and tried to do something. Tell us about some of these people.
There's the group around the thin thread. We call them the thin thread group. It's the guy who started it, a crypto mathematician named Bill Binney. There's a guy named Kirk Wiebe. There's Ed Loomis, who we've already heard. They were all working to try to inside the organization, following the rules. These are rule followers, these guys, 40 years in the government, former military, a lot of them, trying to get the government to pay the inside bureaucracy of the NSA to pay attention and not do what they consider to be illegal activity. When the NSA bosses wouldn't listen to them, they then took it to a woman named Diane Rourke, who's this amazing figure, a Senate staffer in the House Intelligence Committee, worked for Porter Goss, very powerful person.
Talk about a patriot, by the way, but go right ahead.
She's great. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you mean Porter or Diane?
Well, I'm talking about Diane Rourke.
Yeah.
Oh,
amazing.
My God.
Amazing. And she, as they say in television, jumps off the screen. She's just spectacularly a powerful force that said, wait a minute, and did everything she could with the thin thread group inside the government, not going to the press, not breaking any of the rules, inside the government to get it changed. But, of course, the importance of the secret from Cheney, Addington, Hayden, Tenet, all of Gonzalez, all of them was so critical to the existence of it. It had to be a secret. I mean, in many ways, that's what the film is about what kind of secrets we'll try to keep. As they say, it's never the crime, it's always the cover-up. And in this case, it was the idea of it didn't even exist, and that had to be the way they all played it. Well, Diane and the Thin Thread group were trying to break it, and another guy named Tom Drake, who was a very high-ranking person there, stayed inside. The others left the government. Tom stayed inside, Mr. Drake, and tried to push it. And the following of all of their journey, trying to do what many of us outside would call the right thing, in the face of the force of this government protecting its deepest, darkest secret, something they've had for, you know, years and years and years and cannot let it go out under the penalty of all kinds of things, including potential felonies that they were committing, breaking the FISA law of the 1970s. Those people, in the face of that kind of forced pushback from the government, did what many people who like the idea of leaking and whistleblowing believe is the most courageous thing that somebody's done in the government in a long, long time.
You know, long before the Edward Snowden and the Guardian and the Washington Post, a story we learn in the documentary almost ran in the New York Times right before the reelection campaign of George Bush. It was spiked by the executive editor, Keller, and later James Risen, who spent some time with us recently, who was the reporter, one of the reporters in the case, decides to write a book, and then all of a sudden the pressure is on the New York Times to act like the New York Times. So the Baltimore Sun gets something. The New York Times' hand is forced. They print something, and all of a sudden, rather than going after the illegality at the top of government, they decide to go after the leakers. And one of my favorite lines, Michael Kirk, in this whole thing is, I think he's then the Attorney General, Gonzalez, says they broke the law. The DOJ, Department of Justice, goes after those who broke the law, meaning the leakers, not the people who are violating the Constitution. And they not only go after these people, most of whom are lifers who have spent the pocket protector types, as you say, loving this country, loving the NSA. Listen to this account from United States of Secrets, of the lengths the FBI went to track down NSA employees who were leakers within the government. Listen to this.
At 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, the FBI, with guns drawn, raids the homes of Binney and Wiebe. And out on the West Coast, they raid the home of Diane Rourke, waking her up.
It was quite shocking. And in fact, they went through the whole house and went through every book, every paper, every drawer, turned the mattress over, you know. It was quite shocking.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning, and I see these blue uniform with gold FBI on the back people coming across left to right, and I said, well, it sent a chill through me immediately.
Well, the first I knew the FBI was in my house was the guy pointing a gun at me when I was coming out of the shower.
You know, you laugh when you hear this.
But this is unbelievable. It's just so frightening that they're like thugs, these guys from the FBI. And then tell us what happened to Thomas Drake, one of the other people that was involved and stayed and chose to stay in the government.
They hit Drake about 6 months after they hit the others. They take all of his stuff out of his basement. They take computers. They take other things. And they pull him in. He uses all of his retirement savings. He mortgages his house. He literally, whenever the government, if the ton of bricks fall on you by the government and they want you to flip, the money it costs you, I mean, it's astonishing for people who don't know what happens. You step up, the price you pay, if the FBI decides to put you in its gun sights, literally in some cases, is profound. What they were obviously trying to get Drake to do was say that he or the other groups of the other people of the Thin Thread group, one of them or all of them, had spoken to James Risen and Erich Litblau from the New York Times. So they were after the leak, and in return for that, or as part of that, what they decided to do was make the pressure so intense on Drake that he would flip and give somebody up or something up. Drake didn't really have anything to give up. He hadn't done anything, and the Thin Thread group hadn't done anything. As Risen tells us in the film, they'd never actually done anything. But what the pressure that was brought on him was pretty phenomenal, all the way down till couple of days before he was supposed to go to trial for espionage.
Facing years and years and years.
Facing 35 years in prison.
Yeah.
The federal prosecutor had said to him, Mr. Drake, you're screwed. We're going to. And when Drake wouldn't flip, he said, this is according to Drake, he said, well, then we'll go with what we have. And what they had was documents that they found in Drake's basement that said they said were classified documents. So he has classified documents in his basement. They have no proof that he ever met or saw anybody at the New York Times, and they have no proof that he distributed those documents, but they have those documents, which he's not supposed to have in his possession. So what does his defense do? The defense, which is by then a public defender, asks Jim Bamford, the writer of Puzzle Palace and lots of other great books about the NSA, asks Bamford, hires him, and says, look at the documents and see if these things or really should be classified. And Bamford goes on the web and finds them available, readily available on the web as unclassified documents, and the government had put them there. So what they discover, what the attorneys discover, is that the government had pulled the unclassified documents out of his basement, decided that they should have been classified documents, drew a line through the unclassified part of it and said, these are classified documents, but of top secret documents. Of course, they weren't. The case fell apart. Drake was fined $25 and given a year's community service. But in return, of course, he ended up losing not only his career at the NSA, not only his life savings, not only his retirement, but he now works in a mall in Maryland at an Apple store at the Genius Bar.
You know, it's one, we're talking to Michael
so
Kirk,
unbelievable.
Who is the man behind United States of Secrets. You can see tonight, Frontline on PBS. You know, Marjorie mentioned the heroes, a word I is so overused. But in this case, these I don't know, mid to high level staffers at NSA who had the courage to essentially defend the Constitution. You come out of this. Congress was pathetic. Bill Keller at the New York Times, embarrassing. Barack Obama campaigns, and you have great sound from him, no more secrecy. Everything will be done with a warrant. And listen to this just for a second to give you one further headache. Here's the Richard Clark, who became pretty famous in America. New York Times reporter Peter Baker and Washington Post Barton Gellman on President Obama's decision to keep President Bush's NSA program intact.
When you get into office, when you're the man, when you're in the White House, you don't want to give up any tools that you inherit. You don't want to give up anything that might get you that one fact that will stop an attack.
He made his decision. The program would continue.
He had a chance to say, well, that's too far. Let's not sweep in quite so many people who don't have anything to do with terrorism as part of this broad sweep. And he chose to keep the programs largely intact.
I'm not aware of any case in which Obama pushed back hard and said, you can't do that.
You know, the end of the story, to me, Michael Kirk, is every time Congress, in a rare moment of strength, asks the White House, well, tell us an attack you prevented as a result of this broad sweep, either unconstitutional according to many, closely so to others, they still haven't been able to come up with one example of anything that's been thwarted by this massive intrusion into the private lives of Americans, have they?
No, and in fact, the president's commission that he named with five of his closest associates, former associates, who were looking into the program, including Dick Clark, they called themselves the Five Guys, looking closely at what had happened with the program. Of the 46 things they recommended to change that had to be done to the president, he ignored a tremendous number of them. One of the things was, to me, the most surprising thing was that they said that the telephone records process, which is an unbelievably huge thing, yielded no results whatsoever. That, and I think, you know, you can probably extrapolate. If they, believe me, I think if they had, Mike Hayden is willing to talk about enough things, mm-hmm. that if they had a great example,
they'd be telling us about it.
It seemed like we'd know that it was better than the Brooklyn Bridge burn down that they were threatening.
One last quick thing from me, Michael Kirk. What do you think of James Snowden, who, of course, is in exile? Edward Snowden, who is in exile now for turning over all these documents to
Think it's, you know, it's one of those questions a lot of people ask me, and it's the hero or traitor dichotomy in some ways. And I always dodge the question and say, watch the film and you tell me what you think of Edward Snowden. What I know about him was this was a completely thought through thing. I don't know of another whistleblower that literally took a job so that they could grab all the documents he grabbed. I think he watched what happened to the whistleblowers we've been talking about. All those stories that broke in 2005 and early 2006. All those stories didn't have any paper attached to them, really. They had a little bit of this or that. But as we all know in the news business, it didn't have legs. It really didn't. We thought, well, the privacy isn't palpable, invasion isn't palpable enough, whatever. What Snowden decided to do was he not only needed some paper, he needed a lot of paper. And he needed to distribute it to people who would actually distribute it. So he kept it intentionally away from the New York Times and gave it to Bart Gellman at the Washington Post or Laura Poitras, the filmmaker, or Glenn Greenwald, the blogger.
Because he was disgusted with how the New York Times had dealt with the story prior to the election by spiking it.
Precisely. And all big media, for that matter. I mean, he just believed all big media is in the pocket of the White House, and he has plenty of proof to show it after watching it for all these years. So Snowden was very controlled about that. What he didn't plan was what to do once he'd released it. And he didn't. And it's amazing that a guy who thinks it through at that level then finds himself hidden in the streets of Hong Kong, in China, of all places, and no escape plan anyplace else. That's, I think that amazes Gelman and Greenwald and others, and Laura, the others that we've talked to about this. Hero or traitor? I mean, I think you watch it and you decide.
Yeah, let me tell you, you watch it for just one last piece of review. Every single key player on all sides of this, other than this David Addington from Cheney's office, everyone's here. And when you see the faces, and I think you'd agree, Marjorie, of the men and women who have had the courage to stand up to their government to protect all the rest, it's just, it is so moving. Yeah. Michael Kirk is brilliant.
Congratulations.
Thank you for your time.
A really fantastic job. Michael Kirk is the writer, director, and producer of the very upsetting new Frontline documentary, The United States of Secrets, Part 1, airs tonight. Check your local PBS stations for listings. You can catch Part 2 next Tuesday. Michael, again, thank you for joining us, and
thanks.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to ask you about government surveillance. After hearing the liberties that our government has taken when it comes to spying on United States citizens, are you outraged or have you just kind of checked out? We're taking your calls next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.